All right. The March 21st, 2017 House Committee on Veterans Affairs and Emergency Preparedness is now open. We're going to open up an informational meeting. We're going to start with Mr. Sean McCormick, the Director of Financial Administration Division, Oregon Military Department, to make us smarter, hopefully a lot smarter, on something called the EMPG grant, et cetera, et cetera. We are here for you.
Well, I very much appreciate that, sir. Very much indeed. Chair Evans, members of the committee, I'm Sean McCormick. I'm the Director of Financial Administration for the Oregon Military Department. And in a previous life, I was the Mitigation and Recovery Services Manager at the Office of Emergency Management. And that is the section that oversees the Emergency Management Performance Grant, which is what we're here today to talk about. So we're going to give you an overview of EMPG. We're going to talk about EMPG in Oregon. We're going to discuss the funding levels associated with that grant, how we allocate those funds to locals and tribes, what that grant does, i.e. what does it pay for in today's world, and then some of the future issues potentially impending for EMPG. So the purpose of EMPG in Oregon is to help implement, maintain, and expand the statewide emergency services system. That system is meant to operate to provide education, information, training, and a coordinated response, recovery, and mitigation action for the citizens and the visitors of Oregon. I think it's fair to say that it's the expectation of the legislature and the governor that the Office of Emergency Management is going to be able to provide leadership and coordination before, during, and after any type of emergency situation. And that's what EMPG allows them to do. It finances their operations. The grant itself acts as the foundational funding source for emergency management operations across the nation. All states, to the best of our knowledge, utilize EMPG funding to pay for staff costs that are related to emergency management. The grant itself does require a 50% non-federal hard cash match. It's a nationwide requirement. All states operate with it. All states accept it. The grant itself is operationally focused as it pays for the cost to actually perform emergency management operations at the city, county, tribal, and state level. So EMPG in Oregon is what we call a people grant. The funds are distributed to all levels of government, city, county, tribal, and state. There was a modification to law done in 2013 which allowed tribal nations to be eligible to access EMPG funds for the first time. It was a piece of legislation brought forth by OEM, and we were very happy that it was able to be passed. Requirements for all applicants to receive EMPG funds include having a dedicated emergency manager, having a national incident management system compliant emergency operations plan, one that's on file both locally and with the Office of Emergency Management, and that EOP be updated every 2 years. They also have to have a FEMA-approved natural hazard mitigation plan, again, on file both locally and with the Office of Emergency Management, have an emergency operations center, and be able to operate under the incident command structure. For cities, we have an additional requirement. They have a population of over 85,000 in order to be eligible for EMPG, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when we get into the funding formula. So OEM acts as the recipient of EMPG funds from the federal government, so Department of Homeland Security, to OEM, and then OEM passes those funds through to city, county, and tribal programs. Currently, we have 35 counties, 5 cities, and 4 tribal nations receiving EMPG funding. And we'll talk about which ones those are here a little bit later on. So this slide shows the funding that was provided to Oregon from DHS dating back to 2006. Since 2014, you can see that the funding has stayed very consistent at about $5.2 million. Over the last 11 years, OEM, the state, has retained on average about 20 to 21% of the total award while passing through almost 80% to locals and tribes. Oregon routinely leads the nation in the percentage of award that is pushed downstream to cities, counties, and tribes. We believe that all incidents start local, hopefully end local, and we want to make sure that city and county EMs and tribal EMs have the tools and resources to manage them. A little bit later, we're going to discuss what the new federal administration plans are for preparedness grants and potential implications to EMPG here in Oregon. So the previous slide showed how much we get. Now we got to talk about how we allocate those funds downstream. So in order to fairly distribute those funds, OEM created a funding formula in a funding formula committee in 2011 to develop an allocation methodology. That committee worked for nearly 2 years. It was made up of 12 local emergency managers, city and county, and it was staffed by OEM members. In 2013, that committee approved and OEM rolled out an allocation methodology that incorporated a base allocation of fundings of about 50% of the cost of an emergency management position. So one emergency manager, half their fully loaded cost. A secondary allocation is then issued based on population. Those allocation figures are then compared to a formal budget request, which each jurisdiction submits to OEM. It's reviewed, analyzed, compared, and then a final award is issued to each jurisdiction. Funding for tribal nations is currently being funded by reducing the amount of funds retained by OEM. So on my previous slide, where we're showing about 21%, we take 3 to 3.5% of that, withhold it, and that's what we use to fund the programs in the tribal nations. We didn't want to decrement city or county emergency management programs, so we wanted to make sure that the state was financing the cost for tribal programs. After all those allocations are actually made, if there are any remaining funds available, OEM tends to manage those, and they will award them on a one-time basis to local government should they have a need for an additional position. They want to do a planning action, they want to do an exercise, they can come to us, make a recommendation, OEM will review it, analyze it, and then OEM Director Andrew Phelps will make a final determination on whether or not it's funded. In 2015, we'd been in the funding formula world for about 2 years. Andrew thought it was a very good time to reach out to the community to see how they were taking our funding formula. So they sent out a survey to see if they thought it needed to be updated, modified, changed. And we were pleased that about 63% of respondents liked the funding formula in its current structure. So that was a very, very nice thing for us to hear. I do expect Andrew and his team to go back and look at that funding formula in the future. No funding formula is perfect all the time, forever, so it will be looked at some point. So we've talked about how much we get in from the feds. We've talked about how we allocate it. This slide demonstrates what each jurisdiction at the county level receives in 2013. The average award is about $86,000, and I'm sure everybody on here will not be surprised to see that the population centers, Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Marion County, receive the lion's share of the county awards because of the population adjustment. This slide shows the FY16 allocation for the 6 cities and 4 tribes participating. Currently, Hillsborough does not actually accept their award. They're not participating in the EMPG program. And we have 1 county, I believe it's Morrow County, that does not participate in the EMPG program. So those funds go back into the pot.
Excuse me, but why is Hillsborough not accepting their money?
I believe, Jerry Evans, members of the committee, that they don't necessarily want to take part in all the requirements that are associated with accepting EMPG funds. There are training requirements, there are exercise requirements that everybody has to take part in if they want to receive EMPG funds. That's my understanding, but I can validate that and get back to you.
And the money stays in the account then?
The money comes back and can be part of that reallocation.
Okay. Good question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who set a limit of 85,000 population on this, and why would we fund the tribes before we fund our cities?
Chair Evans, Representative Escobar.
They are separate nations.
Yes, sir. Chair Evans, Representative Escobar. The Funding Formula Committee made that determination back in 2013. Again, the committee that was made up of 12 city and county city and county emergency managers, and they felt that those cities that had populations of 85,000 or greater generally cover the lion's share of population in the state. We have had interest from other cities interested in taking part in the EMPG program. I think that's going to be looked at and discussed downrange. But the plan, the formula that was approved by all the jurisdictions is that there was an 85,000 person population requirement for cities.
Okay, but we don't have the same requirement for the tribes.
We do not, and that's why the state takes it out of our pot. Representative Evans, Representative Escobar, the state finances the cost of the tribal nations. They were very interested to become eligible for EMPG funds. The program made an effort. The legislature approved the change to have tribes eligible for the funds, and we didn't want to decrement further the locals, so the state is picking up that share.
Yeah, I didn't know that they had a limit.
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you talked earlier about the requirements for match 50-50. So did the jurisdictions, the counties, and or the cities then, are they the ones that put up the match for the amount of funds they get?
Representative Lively, that is correct.
For the cities.
For the cities and the counties.
And the counties. Okay.
Excellent. So the average award for a city is about $113,000, and the average award for tribal nations is approximately $62,000 right now. So what is being paid for? EMPG and Oregon is paying for about 50% of the cost for 132 emergency management positions across the state, 98 at the local and tribal level, and 34 at the state. It also pays for operational costs such as rent, phones, travel, utilities, some types of equipment. And then it also provides funding for OEM staff to conduct disaster response training and outreach, so activating the ECC, or Emergency Coordination Center, for an exercise, and then also working on managing day-to-day emergency preparedness issues and plans, both for locals and the state. So the future is a little challenging. The president's America First budget contains a $667 million reduction to programs administered by FEMA, which does include the Emergency Management Performance Grant. The National Emergency Management Association is sharing with states that they may expect upwards of a 20% reduction to EMPG awards. 20% in Oregon would be about $1 million. This type of reduction obviously is going to have state-level impacts, and that's going to roll down potentially to reduced awards at the local level. It also may require a revised approach to just emergency management planning at the state level across the entire enterprise. And then there are multiple pieces of legislation at the state level, many of which have been brought forth by this committee. Are being considered this session, that would be absolutely wonderful uses of EMPG funds, assuming the federal dollars are there, and again, assuming that 50% non-federal hard cash match is available. So, in conclusion, EMPG is the lifeblood of emergency management in the state. It's what allows city, county, tribal, and state EMs to do their job. Oregon, as we are in a lot of things, is a national leader in trying to make sure that we get as much federal money downstream to our locals as is humanly possible while still maintaining a robust state emergency management program. EMPG is absolutely critical to the state and to our communities, and we need to do everything we can to help protect it. And that concludes my testimony.
I have questions, but I want to start with the committee. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have missed it, and I apologize for getting here a few minutes late, but what kind of performance measures do these cities have to meet in order to qualify for the grant funding?
Chair Evans, Representative Lewis, there are multiple requirements that every jurisdiction has to go through. I read off a few of them: having the NIMS-compliant emergency operations plan, having a dedicated emergency manager. They have to take part in multiple exercises throughout the year. They have to do quarterly reporting to the Office of Emergency Management, identifying progress in what they put into their budget submittals, and all that is rolled up into a statewide report that OEM then provides to the federal government.
Thank you.
Other questions? Good. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you talked about the risk from the federal standpoint. I would like to understand the current funds, since the federal's on a different fiscal year budget than we are. I'm trying to understand. So if nothing, so the current, whatever funding we have now would carries us through the federal fiscal year. Or how does that work from the standpoint of the grant?
Chair Evans, Representative Lively, you're correct. The federal government operates on a different fiscal year than the state. We're currently working through and operating on the federal fiscal year FY16 award. Surprisingly enough, the FY17 federal award has yet to be announced.
Okay.
We're expecting there to be some level of reduction, assuming the president's budget goes through. Once that grant is brought in, locals will apply for funding through the FY17 grant. The period of performance for these grants is a little challenging. It has technically a two-year period of performance for EMPG, but most jurisdictions operate, as is the state, on a one-year cycle.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. I've got a couple. So, statement and a question. The question is, right now, for the awarding of the grants, are there any requirements of personnel or elected officers or staff support to have been ICS trained, and if so, what percentage?
Representative Evans, there are requirements that people take ICS courses. The emergency managers who are receiving those funds have to be trained. To the best of my knowledge, there is not a requirement for elected officials to receive that type of training, but if your position is going to be financed with the Emergency Management Performance Grant, you have to meet all of the requirements that are in the federal application that the state then passes through, which includes ICS.
But the state can set new requirements on top of the federal.
Representative Evans, that is correct. The state can, if we choose, institute new requirements.
In the state of Texas, for example, I understand that electeds, a certain percentage of the elected board, city council, county, actually have to have ICS training so they understand the role of electeds and the role not of electeds during disaster, which is actually the bigger problem. The other question is, or not really a question, but a statement. When we began the committee hearings this session, one of the things I'd kind of mentioned in terms of the work group's long-term focus is an interim discussion about all the different pots of money that go in to pay for emergency management. And one of the things I think that is a great strength, but also confusing to some people, is how we leverage state dollars to try to make federal dollars stretch farther to provide services that really vary from place to place. And in terms of population of the cities that you mentioned, according to the new population estimates, Bend would be in that list as well as Gresham. So, again, one of those things about the funding formula, we want to be careful about how we construct it to make sure that it's representative and that everybody is given a chance. So thank you for bringing forward this. There will be much more work on this issue moving forward, but this certainly provides a good foundation. Seeing no other questions, we're going to say thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Have a good rest of your day.
Will do.
Now we're going to call up Mr. Ed Tabor, Program Services Manager, Business Oregon, to talk about the Seismic Grant Program. Welcome. Please have a seat. Tell us your name, your background, and what we're going to. Did somebody else come with you that you want to invite up? He's like, no, I don't. That's all right. That's all right. Go ahead.
Chairman Evans, committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak here today. For the record, my name is Ed Tabor. I am Business Oregon's Program Services Manager. I was asked to address the committee on the issues of seismic grants and provide background on the program. The Seismic Rehabilitation Program was created by the 2005 legislature. The program was originally with the Oregon Office of Emergency Management, but transferred to Business Oregon in 2014. Prior to the transfer from the Office of Emergency Management, awarded $30 million to 42 projects. Since coming to Business Oregon, there have been 76 awards for $78 million. For the current biennium, we are projecting 124 school retrofits, totaling $175 million. $50 million has already been awarded, and 125 will be awarded in April. Also, for the current biennium, we are projecting 20 emergency service retrofits, totaling $30 million. This is a statewide competitive grant program that provides funding for seismic rehabilitation of critical public buildings, particularly public schools and emergency services facilities, to make them earthquake safe. The maximum grant amount is $1.5 million per building. Eligible schools include K through 12, community colleges, and education service districts. Eligible emergency services includes hospitals, fire and police stations, sheriff's offices, and 911 centers. Services covered are architecture, engineering, project management, structural and non-structural improvements. Schools are retrofitted to a life safety standard. Life safety means that a building may be damaged beyond repair during an earthquake, but people will be able to safely exit the building. Emergency service buildings are retrofitted to immediate occupancy standards. Immediate occupancy means not only will the building remain standing after an earthquake, but emergency services will be able to continue operations and provide services. For the award process, there is a rigorous screening of projects and review for eligibility by staff. Applicants submit an application, an engineering feasibility study, and cost estimates and a benefit cost analysis. We provide the tool for the benefit cost analysis and the feasibility study. The local district or school can hire an engineer for technical assistance, can be provided also by the Department of Energy's $25,000. Typically, they range around $25,000, can be for a grant. And again, that's from the Department of Education. Staff then reviews the information provided and fills out a detailed checklist and makes notes to consulting engineer and Ken Gettle, who is an international project expert contracted by the department. They do a thorough review and they provide a report, project matrix of all the projects, which goes to the Seismic Advisory Committee, which is made up of 20 members, 10 statutory members, and 10 other expertise. The committee rate and rank all eligible applicants and decide on the funding. So how do they rate and rank? When rating and ranking, they look at the scope of work, financial feasibility of the project, the entity's ability to complete the project, historic importance of the building, and the benefit cost analysis. The benefit cost analysis is similar to what FEMA uses to review projects and evaluate risk, which includes seismic hazard, vulnerability, economic losses, and occupancy. Then they start with the most highly risked project and go down the list from there until they run out of money. In regards to the need, from the Department of Geological and Mineral Industries, DOGAMI, a study completed in 2007, they estimated there were approximately 293 schools at very high risk, with another 800 considered high risk. The study estimates the cost to partially retrofit the school buildings at $1.64 billion. The study also estimated that there were 54 very high risk and 195 high risk emergency services buildings, totaling approximately $3.74 billion. As you are aware, we have a $202 million policy option package in the governor's budget for this program. Chairman Evan, that completes my information.
I know that there are a couple of questions pending, but I will hold and ask.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So are the schools or the emergency facilities and that, so what kind of match are they required? Is there a standard match that they're required, or does it depend on the project and the cost of the project? Because I think you said up to $1.5 million.
Correct. So there is no match requirement, but they do have to have the funds to complete the project.
So there's no match requirement.
Correct.
Okay. I'll start. Some other questions may be generated. So the advisory committee that helps on the grant process, that is not OSPAC, right? OSPAC has a separate function, maybe has some ideas about this, but they're not actually the group that you use to help select the grants. Is that correct?
That's correct, Chairman.
Okay. Second is, if possible and highly encouraged, I'd like to see a list of the 42 and the 76, the 42 communities that received a grant before you got the football, and then the 76 after you've got the football, just so we can see what communities are in fact getting through this process the most support, if that's possible.
Definitely, we can provide that, Chairman.
The third, not so much a question, something confuses me, is the difference between life safety and immediate occupancy standards. I get the immediate occupancy standards for the emergency services. One of the things that concerns me a little bit about having it for the schools, and again, I like life safety better than nothing, but life safety, back a few years when Susan Castillo was running superintendent of schools, there was a recognition that post-event high schools and other schools have a role to play after an event because of the size, scale, and shape of just what they have. Now, I'm not exactly certain that schools should be the morgues like they had originally identified, but that getting kids back to school to try to get normalcy again is one of those things important. Why did they settle on the life safety standard instead of the immediate occupancy standard for schools?
Chairman, I think the biggest reason is literally to save the kids first and foremost. The occupancy, again, we're
just talking about a different standard of construction, right? For remodeling and repair.
And I think a big portion of that would be the cost involved. Costs quite a bit more to bring to a life safety or immediate occupancy than a life safety.
Is there a ratio or a formula or some type of? I mean, how do you tell what life safety is for a police station versus immediate occupancy, and vice versa for schools?
Chairman, there is. I don't know the exact formula, but there is standards for that distinguish between the two.
And again, if you don't have them today, that's fine, but if you could share them with us, I think that'd be very helpful.
We can definitely share that with you.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Thank you. So I had a follow-up question. So given the number across the state of schools and that, from a school standpoint or even from an emergency services standpoint, obviously those closer to the coast to where the event might occur are of greater risk than those that are further east. So is there some priority given from the standpoint of our investment related to where the highest risk might be versus just, I'm not sure what the criteria is otherwise.
Sure. Chairman and Representative Lively, the buildings are not designed to a specific earthquake level of ground shaking for any given earthquake. Earthquakes vary markedly depending on the depth of the earthquake, distance from the epicenter, and the site of the location. Seismic design of buildings is based on a consensus standard, probabilistic seismic hazard data tabulated by the USGS. Buildings located in high seismic areas, such as the Oregon coast, are designed to resist higher seismic events and forces than buildings in central or eastern Oregon.
But I think what the representative is asking, just maybe to help out here, is not the standards difference in terms of geography, but rather of the 40, 42 and 76, have we prioritized or are we prioritizing those areas that are a higher risk for the funding?
Again, they're based on their risk assessment and the rating and ranking. I don't believe that there's extra points given necessarily for the coast versus eastern Oregon, but it would be weighed out in the rating and ranking.
So we could be theoretically putting as much effort into funding schools in Umatilla and Bend as we are in the coast on seismic concerns.
Could, but I think it shows that the higher risk is on the coast, and that's evident in the when you look at it on a map. We have more schools being retrofitted on the coast, and
do we do
in the valley? We do.
Okay.
Yes,
and that'd be nice to see that list.
I think that's why the list would help us fight our way through the confusion on this.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions? So I have another one. How much total bonding authority was there passed for this program?
So, Chairman, the funds that have been awarded, all the funds that have been made available have been awarded. The total for all program before and after it came to our division or our agency, $108,407,000.
Because I remember when, and the reason I'm trying to reconcile this in my brain is when I remember Senator Courtney fighting to get the bonds on the ballot, because there had to be some accommodation made there, it was in the billions of dollars over time. Is there a way that we could perhaps get a primer on how long this program can last, what bonding capacity we can expect in the future? Because I think that it has been enough time now that not enough of us were involved in understanding how it was put in place that we kind of want to see what we can anticipate without any other changes as far as money available to do these things, perhaps so we can maybe even try to add more to it if that's necessary. Is that something we could get?
Chairman, we could provide that for you. Again, as I stated before, the need currently is about well, from the 2000 report was over $2 billion.
Right.
And by the end of this, by April, we'll have funded $263 million in projects. But as far as having that formula based, you know, take it further out, we can provide that information for you.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to add to that conversation. So we have another bonding program, which is the bonding program that helps supplement to build new schools. So districts can apply, those districts especially that had troubles selling bonds in the past. So in some cases, because of the other bonding program we have that allows for construction of schools, some of these schools will be replaced rather than having to be retrofitted. And what we know from that program has been very successful. There's districts that have passed bond measures that haven't in years that are able to use the state portion as a way to leverage local funds to replace schools. So there's a couple things going on here that helps address the same, ultimately the same group.
Right. And again, are you does Business Oregon handle that grant program, or is that through ODE?
We do not handle that.
Okay. So we need to bring in. Okay. So the other question is, I know that there were a number of schools in terms of priorities for investment. What about the public safety side of the house? Police station, fire station, EMS, hospitals, and 911 centers, I think is what you said.
Correct.
Where are we in terms of the size and scale of the problem and the size and scale of funding projects with that particular stream?
Chairman, that same study identified 54 very high-risk emergency buildings and 195 high-risk for a total of $3.74 billion. And the schools was $1.64 billion. I think I misspoke before when I said the 3.67. Yeah. That was just for emergency buildings.
Really?
And I don't believe they have a bonding for new facilities, which is, again, I think a longitudinal look of those two streams would really be helpful, because as some communities wrestle with just the aging out of their structures, if we can somehow find ways to facilitate community investments at the same time the state seismic fund may be available, we might be able to provide greater capacity after a catastrophic event. So I think that'd be very helpful.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? All right, well, please pass on to your director. We appreciate you coming, and we look forward to those follow-up reports. And
right away, Chairman.
When we go into the interim, so you got a little bit of breathing time because I know you have other things to do during session. But in the interim, we are going to be trying to put together a work group on understanding how all these pieces of funding fit. So it's kind of a heads up. We're going to be inviting you to participate in that. All right.
Great. Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Okay, this concludes the informational hearing that we had for today. We're going to. Are you ready for your public hearing?
Yes, but I'm actually going to ask other people to come up and explain the bill.
Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2895, and I'm going to ask Mr. Volk to explain it.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. House Bill 2895 appropriates $1 million of general funds to the Department of Education for seismic needs assessment in 27 school districts where seismic needs have not been conducted. It declares an emergency. As far as background, Oregon faces a serious statewide risk of earthquake hazards. The Cascadia subduction zone, as we've all heard, looms offshore. The risk of tsunamis along the coast and ground shaking present ever-present challenges. Most of the schools and buildings in Oregon were built long before a 1993 statewide building code revision mandated seismic design standards. A 2007 survey conducted by the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries listed more than 1,000 schools in Oregon at high risk or very high risk of collapse in a major earthquake and identified several school districts as not having seismic assessments. Oregon has a web-based statewide inventory of public education buildings rated for seismic risk. Also, Oregon also has a voter-authorized and funded grant program to provide finance for seismic upgrades of public schools on a risk-prioritized basis. To receive a grant, however, a seismic assessment must first be conducted, and it can be a challenge for smaller school districts. We have received the fiscals and revenues, and not surprisingly, the fiscal says the total funds would be $1 million as requested. There, all of this is online.
That's all.
Pretty straightforward.
Okay, we have Representative Parrish, who I understand is going to remain up here, but we also have Sam and Mark, if you want to step up. We'll start off with Representative Parrish, and then when you guys speak, if you could say your name and where you're from clearly into the mic, that'd be helpful for us to keep records.
Thank you. Well, just briefly, because I want to let other people have a chance to speak, but bringing this bill at the request of Superintendent Thielman, who represents the ALSEI school district, but also is very connected to some of the other smaller school districts who, historically, we don't always do a great job on. We've tried to, with small school funds and things, to equalize school funding for smaller districts, but they, on the bonding side and on the construction side, just really have a tough time going out to their communities to raise the money that they need to do the types of upgrades that need to happen. Seismic certainly being one of them among all the other things that we try to address with schools on schools construction. And so there are districts who have not ever conducted a seismic assessment. And I think given the state of our impending at some point earthquake, it would be helpful to understand the needs and challenges of all school districts. So we're bringing forward this bill to ask for some dollars to make sure that every school district has a seismic assessment that we can understand what the future needs are in terms of any bonding requests that may come to the state. They don't even know what their needs are yet because there's no assessment. So I'll just turn it over.
All right. Go ahead.
Okay, and I'm going to turn it over. This is one of my students, Sam Littlefield, and so I'm going to let him get started.
Mr. Littlefield, welcome.
Chair Evans and other members of the Veterans and Emergency Committee, my name is Sam Littlefield, and I am a senior at ALSEI High School. Thank you so much for taking the time to hear about our rural community and schools' need for a seismic assessment on infrastructure. As those key stakeholders and legislators explained, the state very wisely invested in a comprehensive seismic assessment of many public buildings back in 2007. As I have studied and learned about the work that has been done, I've become acutely aware of the importance of emergency preparedness regarding school buildings, specifically K through 12 school buildings. In my research and review of the seismic assessment documents, I was surprised to see that the school that has given me so much and enriched my formative years and those of the surrounding community was not included in the assessment. Perhaps even more surprising was the realization that the local fire station, a mere two blocks away, did get one. However, we did not. Due to this apparent double standard and education needs, I had to ask, why did the people that drove all the way up to ALSEI to assess the fire station did not also assess our school? Because of this question, my principal and superintendent encouraged me to participate in the legislative process for part of my senior project to learn about bills that potentially address disastrous issues, especially for rural communities. It is this reason that I am here to ask for help, as this is the most important building as in our community because it acts as not only our only school building, but our emergency and safety shelter during times of crisis. Thank you again for this great opportunity to present before the members of the Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee. Does this committee have any questions?
You did very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for Sam? All right. Well, that's a heck of a question you raised. I'm looking forward to trying to find an answer. Go ahead. Just,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Sam, thanks for making the trip today, you and your soup.
Thank you.
How old is that school?
1942. Yeah, 1942.
Okay, so it's an oldie. Is it brick? Sorry, follow up.
So I can give the details. It is a, the original building was built in 42 and it's had a couple of additions. The additions are the cinder block, the hollow cinder block, which is always suspect. And then
could you please say your name for the record again?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Superintendent Mark Thielman. So the, and again, for us, we're an isolated community. We're 25 miles from everything. And we've had circumstances where we've had been cut off before and had to open the school to motorists who couldn't get through the highway. And we do a lot of emergency preparedness, ham radio stuff with the Cascadia preparation. We also host the emergency generators and things for the city in the event that power is cut off, which does happen. And from those conversations, it led to what Sam's talking about. I couldn't explain to the kids why we weren't assessed, and we were, of course, had board conversations about do we want to access some of these seismic grants, but we don't really know how to access them because we don't have an assessment. So just for clarity, there's an assessment that was given to all schools except those deemed too small to matter. Those are the wordings that were in the, basically, that's just the paraphrase.
That was Dog Amy's study?
The Dog Amy one, yeah.
Who blamed them?
In the 342-page report, they explained the criteria as to why.
Well, we think ALC matters.
Well,
I don't know about Dog Amy, but we do.
Matter. The good news is, I had a board member say, okay, so the fire station will be there so they can come and dig the kids out of it. And that's where people go. So the good news is, Sam being interested in the process and all that, we picked up this project, and of course, the exciting part is that we're here. And I think the important thing is, there are ways. We did call around to some of the districts, like Mapleton has since. They were not assessed, but they have since got a grant, a technical assistance grant and all that. And my point was, well, they had to apply for that. And that was designed to get engineering so that they could even have an indication of what their seismic retrofit would be. And they may or may not have got that. And my point is, this should be done. We shouldn't have to apply. This should be done. And it's been since 2007. And it's effective for us to have a sense of whether or not the building's going to fall down, because we are the designated emergency center for the community. And we've been telling people, if Cascadia hits and we're cut off and we have no communication outside of ham radios, come to the school. We have emergency generators and things. But we certainly would like the school to be there in standing. So.
Yes, sir. So when I listened to your presentation, I missed understanding clearly. So why were those schools excluded from the original list?
As near as we could understand, and is that they were deemed too small. There was a limited amount of resources. There were also some community colleges as well.
Yes.
That were not assessed. And they did do the fire stations because of that you want people to be able to first respond. So that was done, but it doesn't bode well when you have to want to go to ALC. So if you're going to send a crew of people all the way out there,
right.
And the district owns the land and the building that the fire trucks are housed in.
So if I remember correctly, so now that we teased Doug Gammy, I want to emphasize.
Yeah.
As I remember, when Yumi Wang and crew were putting it together, it was a windshield.
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought.
Tour,
right.
Mm-hmm. That basically they had four or five or six criteria.
Good. That was the first one.
Right.
But we had Ian Maiden in here just last week or two explaining the latest assessment process.
But so. That latest assessment may not be the one they're referencing about being too small to matter.
Yeah, maybe that was.
That's what
I
wondered. Too.
Right.
I think it was a drive-by.
I think there's more current information available is what I'm trying to say. So the 2007 was kind of dropped on us from heaven. And it surprised a whole lot of people that when Yumi dropped it that day.
Uh-huh.
That said, it may still not be available, information about your district, but I do know there have been some follow-ups to that. And what we can do is two things. Number one, we can talk offline and most current to you so we can see if you're listed or not.
Mm-hmm.
The second piece is, are you still in Lincoln County or what?
We're in Benton County.
Benton County. All right.
And, we can talk offline, but there is a more current report that's been given, and we're still not on.
You're still not. Okay.
Yeah. So the fire station is, though.
Your Benton County Emergency Management, have you talked with them about any of their use of their grant money for getting you a study?
Yeah, and you understand we're a small rural community. A lot of things have been done to us in terms of the last 30 years economically and all that, and it just didn't sit well with people for me to go be applying for grants. They think it just should be done. So anyway, that's our pitch to you, is to say you guys have power.
Well, my question is, if Benton County may have money through the EMPG or other grants available,
we have received grants for things like the emergency generator and the building that houses it, and some of those things. We haven't received a grant for seismic assessment.
Okay.
All right, Mr.
Chair. Go ahead.
Thanks. So, if you had a seismic assessment and it said you need to do XYZ to retrofit your school and make sure that if there's an earthquake, you're going to be able to get kids out of there safely. You know, sort of heard the distinction between not having a building fall on you versus having a building that you're able to walk back in after an earthquake.
Which is probably
but
the most important.
You're a small community. You're kind of a community that doesn't have a lot of dollars. I mean, do you feel like if there was some, you had a document in hand that actually you could go back to people who are in your voting school board district and say, here's our issues. How are we as a community going to come together and solve them? That could be a bond. It could be you've got some people who are willing to sling hammers and do, you know, volunteer to do some of the work. Do you feel like that document would actually drive change in your community to fix the building?
So, Rep. Parrish, that document would be critical as a political motivator in the community. Mm-hmm. It would guide everything we do.
Right.
It's absolutely paramount. And so, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say, Sam, first of all, did a great job. And I always appreciate it when high school kids come and talk. I don't know, for whatever reason, some of the committees I'm on this year, I haven't had as many as I've had in the past with some of the other committees I've been on. And you did a great job. I just want you to know, though, I still have some bruises deep in my body from Alcee's football team about 35, 40 years ago, maybe 45 years ago. And so I don't have a lot of sympathy for you.
And that explains a lot.
It does.
You guys have a good football team. So that's perfect. No. But thank you, Sam. Really appreciate you coming. That it takes a lot of courage. And this is what we need more of, is young guys like you, young guys and girls coming here and getting involved in this process. And I'm thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So, while you're here, I'm going to actually invite OSBA up. I see them in the room.
Come on down. You're the next contestant on the
moral support.
And you're doing a fine job of moral support. So please, again, state for your name.
Lori Satinsville for the Oregon School Board. Here for moral support.
I'm here to ask for a request. Mm-hmm. Is there a way that you could, that OSBA from, I assume Alcee is a member of OSBA.
Yes.
Could you get us a list of the schools that don't matter on either list?
They all matter.
That were called that they don't matter? Because it appears that if Mapleton did get something done, there may have been some movement, and I'd like to see the comparison of the two lists and which schools currently aren't on the list. That'd be very helpful.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We can do that. I've been emailing the Office of School Facilities, who does handle the technical assistance grants. And I am a new member to the advisory group on the seismic award grants, so I'm just trying to get up to speed on all of that, so I'm going to be involved more. But yes, we can come up with that. I've just been asking them, is there a solution for this?
I just want to make sure we don't leave anybody out this time. So that's what I'd like to
they
ask.
All matter.
Yes, they do. That's why we're asking. Thank you. All right. Again, great job on bringing this forward.
Thank you very much for having us.
I see no more.
Well, so I have a question, but this may be Representative Boone can answer it. So I'm trying to understand, because I have served on the facilities committee for the Springfield School District for 100 years, I think, and been chair. And I remember the drive-by, the information we got from that. What I'm trying to understand is what happened. Now, we've built a couple of new schools, but I'm trying to understand, so what more investigations happened since then that's given us more complete information about what they might do? Because what that identified was brick walls that might fall or mm-hmm. chimneys that weren't hurt. So I don't know what's been since then from the standpoint the information school districts would have that's different than the drive-by. Do you know, Deb?
Well,
sorry.
Okay.
It's all you.
As far as I know, like I said a couple weeks ago, Ian Maiden from DOGAMI, acting director, basically convinced me to not put my bill in the system, which called for an assessment of schools and emergency, you know, emergency important buildings. Having trouble with the mouth today. And I'm looking here on the grant application process there. And it's going to take more than trying to read this up here, too. But I have never heard that they're too small, that the school doesn't matter, it's too small, so it won't you know, be acceptable. But I know that there's been more ask than money available. And the money was actually tenfold. It's $300 million, I think, for the biennium after last year. But I have heard of some very small schools. I don't know how many kids go to your school, do you know?
Less than 200.
Less than 200. Yeah, and I don't know if there's a, I have no idea.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, I believe the cutoff was 200.
Okay.
What they were looking for, rooms of certain sizes, as I recall, but that was 2006, 2007, when I remember all that rapid, the drive-by, basically.
Yeah, and the drive-by was, I think they were appropriated $60,000. It was like a drop in the hat. But I think we should get Dogami back and find out, you know, what the deal is here, because that's, you know, I know that you, Walport built a new high school up on the hill, didn't they, just last few years?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. They were one of the first on the coast to get up out of the tsunami zone. Seaside will be maybe next, and thanks to getting our bond passed. But this is something that, you know, if that is your designated community evac center, that definitely should give it some points, I would think. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can help you with that. We can get some more information and find out, you know, regardless of the 200 mark or whatever, find out some more.
So I'm a big believer in things called suspenses, not like movie suspense, but like a due date. So we will contact Dogami and roll out the red carpet. If you're watching, you are invited to come and talk to us about the list. The second piece, though, is if in the next 2 weeks or so, time before April 7th, you can get back to me as far as what, how many schools, 200 or less or whatever they are, weren't involved. From your perspective, I'd like to match up your list and Dogami's list and make sure that they are, in fact, the same.
You bet.
And then we can hopefully move forward from there, if that's acceptable to the committee.
And Superintendent Thielman apologizes. Yep. He was in and
needed
to get to another committee.
No problem. And I appreciate you you pitching and come up today. So, and please have a safe trip back to LC, and we will try to keep you in the loop on what we learn as we move forward.
All right. All right? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. I do not see any other names for the public hearing. I would certainly invite anybody who wanted to come and testify. I don't see anybody. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2895. Committee, if that's acceptable, get more information and maybe bring this back and have another public hearing on it. If that's acceptable. Yes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question of the of Representative Parrish. It's pretty specific in this bill on the number of school districts, 27.
You're asking about the bill itself?
No, I just want to make sure that that number is accurate.
We believe, Representative Lewis, we believe that number is accurate.
But this is about the bill?
It's in the bill, because the bill specifically says 27.
Public hearing is back open.
I apologize.
Way
Mr.
to break
Chair.
The rules on your second week of school.
That's all right.
Or whatever.
I'm learning.
So, Representative Lewis, yes, the bill, House Bill 2895, does specify a specific number of schools with a specific dollar amount. If Dogami says that that number is different, then we could certainly adjust that number down. I would hope it's different because it's down, and we've been trying to get some of these needs assessments done. But that's the number that I think is the last known number.
Okay,
thank you.
And you got that from Dogami?
I think he did. I think Superintendent Thielman did. I say
okay.
When we asked Dogami to come back here and give us what they think versus what school OSBA and school districts think.
Right, we're asking, but it's your bill, so I was asking the 27 is.
And Superintendent Thielman was where I got that number from.
Okay. Any other question before we? Yep, go ahead.
No questions, but I just showed Representative Lively, too, right on Dogami's site on the rehab grant program, who can apply: public K-12 schools, community colleges, education service districts, for emergency service facilities, emphasis on first responder buildings. This includes hospital buildings with acute inpatient care facilities, fire station, police, sheriff's office, 911 centers, and emergency op centers. But it doesn't say anything about population or anything there. So
I think the question wasn't whether they could apply if they knew they had a problem, but they wanted to get money for an assessment to see if they had a problem.
Oh, to get for the assessment.
Got it.
Okay.
But that's a good clarification, and I appreciate that. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing. All right. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2140, but we have a -2 amendment I believe we want to discuss and move in order to move this bill.
Why don't I reread the...
Please, you hit it, Bradley. You got it.
Chairman Evans, thank you.
We had the last hearing we had was on February 28th, and we talked about the original bill and a dash two amendment. And the original measure added seismic information to the list of required disclosures that sellers must provide to buyers of real property. There was an amendment, a dash two amendment, and it changes the question in paragraph eight. There was, as you may recall, there's a fairly lengthy disclosure form. And the question in the original bill was the house constructed before 1973? And the amendment changed that to, was the house constructed before 1974? The amendment also added another subsection 2, which provided that the amendment to ORS 105-464 applies to sellers' disclosure statements dated on or after the effective date of this act. We have received revenue statements and fiscals on both the original bill and the amendment dash 2, and they're both identical. There is no revenue, and there is minimal fiscal expenditure. So. Basically is the same, and that's the summary.
Change the date?
Change the date, yes.
Yeah. All right, so while we have this open.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments be attached to House Bill 2140.
Okay, we currently have the dash two amendments before us. Mark?
No, our administrator had. Said it should be adopted?
Yeah. I move to adopt.
We move to adopt.
Whatever.
Yep. Representative Escobar has moved to adopt the House Bill 2140-2 amendments dated February 8th, 2017. Is there any discussion?
I don't want to be picky, but I think adopt and attach is about the same thing.
I think adopt and attach are fine. Both are assumed to be part of this message. Any comments or questions on this? Okay, seeing none.
I don't dare. Really.
Call the roll for accepting the dash two.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. We have attached the House Bill 2140-2 amendments to the bill.
Whatever makes him happy.
That's right.
Whatever makes him happy.
Now we have the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2140 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel has moved House Bill 2140 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, hit it, Sky.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
I'm still thinking.
It is for Portland.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
That's right.
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. All right. What I'd like to do is I'd like to assign Co, if possible, just in case.
That's a good point.
I'd like Representative Boone and Representative Post to co-carry this on the floor.
There you go.
And you can talk about.
Oh, holy cow.
See, be careful what you wish for.
My job is to help build relationships.
Questions to the carrier on.
Yes.
No, there not be one question.
I think we should.
No.
Representative Boone, co-carry Representative Post. All right.
Good bill should pass.
We're going to close the work session on that. Now we're going to actually briefly discuss before we conclude our business today where we are in work sessions or work groups. And I want to talk briefly about a couple of dates that are coming up and a couple of requests from agencies that are starting to get the point of the work group. So April 3rd, DPSST, Representative Esquivel, Representative Lewis, DPSST, and OEM are anxious for the conversation about joint training opportunities. That was
sure
confirmed today.
They're wringing their hands.
They're very excited. I heard that from them today. Also, I want to briefly pass the baton to Representative Meek to talk about the work group on airports. You had a great meeting recently. If you could just give us just a couple minutes on where we're at, what we're doing, and when the next one might be.
Yes, thank you, Chair Evans. We had a meeting on Friday, had some really key Partners around the state, the Oregon airport managers, the aviation department, the governor's office, and we actually looked at the playbook, quote unquote, of and the different plays that we will be responding to related to airport facilities. How we will be responding to a Cascadia event or any other similar emergency issue that arises. And we had really good input, and it was just about 45 minutes. We had this great meeting, and everybody got to go around the table letting us know where they were at, what they could provide, and how we could come up with our couple of sheets. And we've set some assignments, and we should be able to provide two of our three components within about a month here, and also has really good, thoughtful, and pertinent information to share and help us keep this moving forward for emergency preparedness.
Great. Okay. Representative Post, I know you were working. Somebody had a health issue. Has that been?
I had a great phone conversation with, I can remember his name now, John Cones.
The team?
And so we have several amateur radio folks that are very interested in coming down here and talking to us. And then I'm working, I just received an email 11:40 this morning from Terry, I don't know if it's, is it Petras? Petras, does anybody know? From
Patrice?
P-I-E-T-R-A-S.
Petraeus?
I don't know, but he's with OEM.
Terry.
But he's, so Terry, okay. And he wants to be here, but he's got to run it through the channels, get permission.
We'll help them with that.
Yeah, okay. So that's what we're working on. And what I've told them is I thought that we might want to look towards late April, early May to get through all of our business and then get to that. So everybody's excited about doing something. So
that's great. Thank you. And Representative Lively, I know your transportation policy stuff is, in fact, working on these issues.
It is. And so the subgroup I serve on, which is has to do with seismic, but also preservation and maintenance net. So the subgroup made a report last night, so that part of it is over, so now we'll have time with, I mean, it's going to be a long process, but the amount of time we were taking the vote out on that to do the subgroup work concluded. But yes, it was interesting in those conversations, because one of the things that came out, and we heard it here in this committee earlier when from Oregon State they came and talked about, so one of the discussions that came out in that committee was the priorities that the state has placed on those routes. And why isn't Southern Oregon a priority? Because the odds are much higher that Southern Oregon will have an event versus, you know, so that's one of, so we have, this is a perfect time to start those conversations.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add a little bit to that. Stu Foster is on the OTC, and he said there's got quite an intricate plan on escape routes and ways to get in and out of the valley.
Well, the good news is you've developed a plan down there that can be implemented fairly inexpensively that provides a route. It isn't the best, but it does, which is good because we don't have to wait for the billions of dollars we don't have. But in relationship to the total plan, and that's where we'll get a chance to talk about it later, is the overall, the plan, the focus of the total plan right now and what resources we have. There's still a question about, even with that, if it isn't in our best interest, that we would still prioritize some investments down there versus some of the investments we're making up north.
That's about $45 million just to do the seismic retrofit on the bridges just to get out.
Right.
But the infrastructure, I think they've got a pretty good handle on it.
Yeah, well, the timing's good to go ahead now and have those conversations.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
Representative Parrish, next week, Citizen Corps is coming here.
Okay.
So we can kick off the conversation about Citizen Corps credentialing.
Okay.
Our team has had a little bit of a, shall we say, a journey trying to get to the bottom of where Citizen Corps is. It used to be housed at Oregon Volunteers. It is no longer housed at Oregon Volunteers. So we are trying to track that down, and I'm told that when they're here, they will be prepared to kick off that conversation. I look forward to your work on that.
Great. And so far, I'm a little behind the curve on all that. I just have to figure out where the curve starts. The other piece of that group,
credentialing and document protection.
Document stuff. The person I would like to try to invite to our committee to come and talk is Mary Beth Herkert. She works out at Secretary of State's office. She recently held a opportunity for all of us as legislators to come and learn the system that they are using in the Secretary's office. A handful of legislators showed up, something I would like to see us sort of model as the legislature in terms of management and storage of public records, which are redundantly stored elsewhere. But they use a software system called TRIM, which comes out of the Navy. Bite my tongue on that, but the Navy started that software program, and it's now commercially available. It's used across a lot of governing agencies, and it does allow that records become immediately storable, usable. It's very easy to use. If every public employee in the state was using it, I think she said it would be like $10 per person per month, so $120 a year per legislator to have all of our documents retained. There is sort of that piece, though, I think that I'd like to try to figure out about how do you help a government like, you know, down on the coast, whether it's a small city or school district, actually also look at and evaluate that piece around records retention, getting things scanned in, because it's not so much just to have the software on your computer. There's all the work of getting, you know, someone standing there and scanning documents.
Right.
And what would that actually cost the state, and how would we pay for that? But I think it'd be interesting for you to understand what is currently available to us if we chose to partner with the Secretary's office to use that type of software.
We'll certainly invite her to come, especially probably after the first deadline when we have time for hearings. And hopefully by that time, Citizen Corps will have kicked off that conversation, and we can supply you some help on that. Representative Boone, I know you've been traveling a great deal, and what I'm hoping to do is actually supplement your work group with both Representative Lewis and myself, probably a second tier, probably start working on that in April for Seaports, and just to basically provide some support on that.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate that.
So last thing on work groups, here's the deal. If you have ideas, suggestions, comments, or you want people there and they're not showing up, I'd like to say they'll come because of me, but that's not true. I'll just give their name to the speaker, and the speaker will call, and people will actually show up.
There you go. Yep.
That said,
we vote on their budgets.
Yeah. That also, for Oregon Emergency Management and all things military, I was asked to make sure that we go through Sean McCormick to make sure. Now, Sean McCormick will not be the person briefing, and he's not the expert on everything, though he's pretty good at finance. But he's the major contact point that they prefer us go through. That said, for Ares, that would touch OEM. For Citizen Corps, they're saying it's back in OEM, so we will follow up with that. If for the FEMA ICS training, KJ Craig Miles used to do that. We're trying to basically track that down so you get the right people at that meeting. So the work groups are, in fact, I think, starting to stimulate conversations we were hoping to have. Just want to say thank you for what you're doing. I also want to say thanks for the very fast turnaround on the amendments to another bill that you all basically kicked back in like 2 days, which is very fast for a work group. So between Representative Lively and Representative Post work group on House Bill 2100, which got a lot of really important conversations together and move the bill, to your work group on the amendments, I just really appreciate you guys doing that.
It was easy.
Well, it got done well.
Stop assigning so much homework.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So, but on that note, I'm going to try to give you most of a sunny afternoon back. I appreciate all your efforts and look forward to Thursday. Thursday, Brad, if you can give us a quick update on what to expect Thursday, we'll get you out of here.
Yes, for Thursday we have three informational speakers and three bills, House Bill 3075, House Bill 3132, and House Bill 3174.
Okay. All right. We're closed. Adjourned. Closed. Adjourned. All right. We're